Today's program is proudly brought to you by Whole Foods Market. Visit wholefoodsmarket.com or download the Whole Foods Market app to learn more and find the store nearest to you.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Good afternoon, and welcome to Eating Matters, where we talk about food policy and how it impacts all of us. I'm your host, Jenna Liute, and we're broadcasting live from Roberta's on Heritage Radio Network. I want to talk about one piece of legislation that is arguably most impactful to our food system, and one that touches almost every aspect of the food policy work happening in this country right now. I'm talking, of course, about the Farm Bill, the behemoth legislation that is up for authorization in 2018. We will undoubtedly be talking a lot more about this as the bill winds its way through the legislative process over the coming months. But to kick off our coverage, I want to first provide a bit of a primer, as it's certainly pretty, let's just say, not easy to navigate. Joining the show to give us an overview of the bill, including what it entails, how it affects the lives of everyday Americans, and what's at stake, is Paul Wolf, Senior Policy Specialist at the National Sustainable Agriculture Coalition, an alliance of over 100 grassroots organizations that advocate for federal policy reform to advance the sustainability of agriculture, food systems, natural resources, and rural communities. Paul, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, let's start at the very beginning, way back when. Can you kind of give us a super brief history of the Farm Bill? When was it first enacted, and why?
So the Farm Bill, as we know it, has been an evolution over many years, but to go back really to the beginning, with the first Farm Bill was passed in 1933, and at that time it was really focused just on farmers. It's much different than it is today, but it was really focused on trying to help them through the Depression and other economic hard times, and prop up prices for crops. Back then, there were 6.8 million farmers, representing 25% of the population living in rural America, and they were going through hard times, and so Congress passed the first Farm Bill to prop up prices, and they did this through a combination of price supports and also planting restrictions. So, they actually paid farmers to not plant in order to help help with prices, and you know that was the way it went for many years, and in different forms and different tweaks and different programs that are down in the details, but. You know, that brings you up to 1970s when things started to change and we started to see other things come in and start to see the Farm Bill develop as we know it today. 1973 was the first time the Farm Bill included food stamps, as they were known. Now it's the SNAP program, Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program.
Mm-hmm.
And in 1977 is when that really came to, we all know or may have heard that Senator McGovern from South Dakota and Senator Dole from Kansas got together and kind of pushed, as we know it today, the Farm Bill with food stamps and farm and rural development programs. They actually, today, those food stamp programs, SNAP, represents 80% of the Farm Bill funding. So as we moved on, we now have this bill that's together and with that kind of rural-urban détente that, mm-hmm. that came together. And we moved along, and then we came to 1985 when we started looking at conservation programs and when conservation programs, as we know them today, were really added to the Farm Bill.
And, okay, so we have... So today are the major tenants still conservation, SNAP or federal nutrition assistance, and then agricultural policy, or what? How would you basically, are there three major tenets? And if so, what is the kind of third bucket that relates to agricultural policy today?
So it's really, it's conservation, it's rural development, it's nutrition programs, which is that big bucket that makes 80%, and farm programs.
Okay. And then what are some examples of the farm programs then? Like, is it still, do we still pay farmers not to plant, planting restrictions, or is that something that was phased out over time?
Yeah, Congress has tried to, over the decades, and especially in the last 35 years, to move away from programs that people consider distorting or really impact markets, and especially related to foreign trade and our trade agreements in the WTO having to not distort prices in that way. So that all culminated when we had something called direct payments, where we actually paid farmers based on their land and what they used to plant, but not whether they planted a crop. But the two programs today that are the main program, have prices, and if prices essentially go below that for crops, that the farmers get a payment. They're a bit more complicated than that. But that's the main part. The other part of it that's really come into its own since the 90s is crop insurance. And this is the program that costs about $8 billion a year, subsidizes farmers' crop insurance payments at 60%, and is the other big part of the farm subsidy program.
Okay, so we're going to talk about that in a few minutes, but you mentioned before that the nutrition assistance, component of the Farm Bill represents 80% of the total funding. What about the other kind of major tenants? What portion of funding is dedicated to those other buckets?
So the other 20% of programs, about half of that is actually crop insurance.
Okay.
20% is commodity programs I just mentioned. Another almost 30% is conservation. And then you have everything else, which is 4%, which is rural development, food safety, trade, forest service, all of these things that the other things that USDA does.
Food safety? That in the Farm Bill? First of all, I think that we should talk about the term farm bill, because it seems like it entails way more than just agriculture or farm policy. Has there been any calls to make this name a little bit more accurate?
Well, over the years, the farm bill, is the colloquial term that we use to describe it. Each bill has had its own unique name, often some of them unintelligible or undecipherable, quite long. At different times, depending on who's in charge, they've been called the Food, Jobs, and Energy Act, and the Farm Security and Rural Investment Act, the Agricultural Risk Protection Act. So they've had all kinds of different names. We call it the Farm Bill, but you are absolutely correct. The Farm Bill today is kind of a Swiss Army knife, for rural communities, for urban health and food safety and many different things. And, a lot of people don't know the Forest Service, that manages millions of acres of land, is part of USDA as well.
What does it entail specifically with our food safety program? What kind of components? What does that look like?
Sure. The main part for USDA is that as part of the Farm Bill is the Food Safety Inspection Service that is in all animal meat processing plants. FDA. Who people often associate with food safety is in charge of the fruits and vegetables and kind of that end of the spectrum, but meat is under the purview of USDA, and so they have inspectors in all those plants monitoring food and doing that, and so they do the inspection of meat, but they also work with farmers of all types to improve and to deal with food safety on the farm, and it's something we've advocated for since the passage of another bill a few years ago to implement food safety procedures back to the farm, is having USDA in its marketing and its farmer assistance part to do something called the Food Safety Outreach Program that we advocate for that actually helps do cost share and helps farmers, especially local and regional direct-to-market farming systems, understand what they need to do to ensure food safety when, you know, these are the operations that can't afford to hire a full-time food safety officer like the biggest commodity farms can.
Mm-hmm.
And so USDA has a role to play to help those farmers ensure that they are able to comply.
Okay, so I want to talk a little bit more about the legislative process. So we're going to get a little bit wonky here, but what is the process, including authorization or reauthorization, and what does it entail, and how often does it happen?
So the Farm Bill traditionally has been done every 5 years. The last one was passed near the beginning of 2014, February of 2014,
mm-hmm.
and that Farm Bill expires at the end of September of 2018. So we're kind of coming to the end of that cycle, and this is a really critical time so it's important that you're talking about this now, because we are kind of at the start of the process to reauthorize this Farm Bill, in time to get it done by that date in 2018. And that's really important because the Farm Bill is kind of unique in a couple ways. If we don't pass a Farm Bill by September of 2018, there's a couple things that happen. The biggest one is we revert to 1940s era permanent laws that don't even contemplate crops like soybeans because they weren't grown back then. So that's a big problem.
Mm-hmm.
And we also have a bunch of programs that support local and regional food systems, like the Value Added Producer Grant Program and the Beginning Farmer and Rancher Development Program, and others that would end and don't have any way to continue. So we're in the start right now where members of Congress are introducing pieces of legislation called marker bills to lay out their ideas and start the debate about the Farm Bill.
Mm-hmm.
And the Senate, the jurisdiction for the Farm Bill is under the Agriculture Committee in the House and in the Senate. And they've been having hearings over the last year to hear from farmers. They've been having field hearings. Our organization has been having meetings and listening sessions with farmers all over the country, and other groups are doing the same thing. So this last year has been kind of the information collection and preparation. We're now moving into the phase where there's pieces of legislation being introduced with members of Congress making their priorities known,
mm-hmm.
and then we'll head into probably early next year having seeing legislative text, seeing people, the committees writing their bills, having something called a markup,
mm-hmm.
where senators and congressmen have the opportunity to offer amendments to the bill and get their priorities included.
Okay.
And it will go through the whole legislative process there and hopefully be finished by September.
And this is a type of legislation where the House and the Senate both propose their own version of the bill, and then there is a reconciliation process?
Yeah, the old how a bill becomes a law. Everybody's seen that Schoolhouse Rock piece.
Not enough people, actually.
So they would each normally come up with their own bill and then go to something called a conference where members from each House and Senate are appointed to a conference and they negotiate the differences out, vote on it again, and then it goes back to the House and Senate to be passed and signed by the president.
Mm-hmm.
That is the normal process. You know, as I'm sure everybody's seen, the legislative process is not quite working like that these days.
No. Yeah, so things are looking up for this.
Yes.
All right.
It's traditionally kind of been considered one of the biggest bipartisan pieces of legislation out there. So we'll see how it goes, and that's the historical context that everybody wants to get it done. And having this big hammer of the expiration in September provides a lot of incentive to work on this.
I mean, so in general, like we've been talking about, we're in very partisan, almost tribal times with our kind of the political parties. So in terms of ideology, do you think that, generally speaking, does the Farm Bill fall within party lines?
The Farm Bill generally is much more related to geography than party.
Okay. So urban, rural?
urban-rural being the most notable because the detente is that the urban members, who are many of them, mm-hmm. Would support the Farm Bill and support that rural policy in exchange for support for the food stamps and SNAP nutrition assistance programs.
Mm-hmm.
And then we also have, north-south, southern commodities like rice and cotton that are not grown in the northern climes have different requirements and wants and needs than your soy and corn and wheat farmers. Those are those Title I commodity programs. You know, we mentioned and how the money is split and how the support is organized. We also have, specialty crop producers, which are specialty crops are what we kind of, they have a specific definition, but it's fruits and vegetables, essentially. A lot are grown in California, in Oregon and Washington on the coast, and in Michigan and in Florida, but not so much in the Midwest.
Mm-hmm.
And so everybody has different things. In the Northeast, land availability for farms is a huge issue, and they don't use crop insurance and those commodity programs very much, but they're very worried about land issues. So there's lots of regional issues that take place in the Farm Bill that don't really fall on party lines other than kind of the urban-rural divide.
So I think, I don't know if I asked you this at the top, but how big is this legislation? And what is and by the way, I promise this is my last kind of wonky question, although that's probably not true. But so how big is this bill overall? And then in terms of funding, is this at the end of every four or five periods, is this where all of the funding is allocated and approved? Or is there a different process for funding versus policy?
So the Farm Bill, is around half a billion dollars per. So it's actually closer to, it's more than that, but it's a lot. it is a huge program. We're talking over 10 years. Mm-hmm. We're talking closer to $100 billion.
Billion. Okay. So it's a big bill. Well, you're billion with a B.
Yep.
Okay. And then how does the process work? Is it, so it's allocated every 4 years, or does it kind of come up for reauthorization every year to continue? Or is it just every 4 years, 5 years?
It continues for the full 5 years of the Farm Bill. There are programs, and this hopefully doesn't get too wonky.
I like it.
Yeah, there's programs that are called mandatory programs, and there's discretionary programs.
Okay.
One discretionary program that we follow a lot is called the Sustainable Agriculture Research and Education Program, SARE.
Mm-hmm.
It's been around since 1988. It's kind of the premier research program on cover crops and other sustainable farming techniques.
Okay.
It's a discretionary program. It's has an authorization for $60 million each year, but we have to advocate every year with the Appropriations Committee in the House and the Senate to get funding for it. If they didn't provide it each individual year, it would have no funding.
So certain components are up for refunding every year?
Yep.
Okay.
And then other components are mandatory. So those components, like the crop insurance program and those commodity programs, the Farm Bill lays out a formula and a mechanism for those to provide money based on price or for crop insurance, 60% subsidy to the farmer, and then, $1 billion of subsidies to the crop insurance companies. And those programs, they have an estimate in that Farm Bill, but they cost what they cost. And so in conservation programs, the CSP program is allowed to enroll 10 million acres of land in this conservation program. So these programs kind of do it by formula, and so their costs vary over time. Crop insurance gets more expensive as commodity prices go up, and the commodity programs get less expensive as commodity prices go up. So these programs kind of they cost what they cost, but they and the ultimate example of this is actually the nutrition assistance program, SNAP,
mm-hmm.
Which provides benefit to everybody that qualifies.
Okay.
There's no cap on the cost, which is why there's a lot of concern out there about people hear this term block granting SNAP to the states,
mm-hmm.
where it would have a cap, because it isn't currently capped. So it costs whatever it costs. If you qualify for SNAP, then you qualify.
Right. So it can go up, it can fluctuate.
Yes.
Okay. So I want to take a really quick commercial break, but when we get back, I want to kind of dive into detail a bit more about the commodity program portion of the Farm Bill. And then, you know, what's next in terms of process. Stay tuned.
Great.
Today's program is proudly brought to you by Whole Foods Market. Whole Foods Market believes in seeking out local, fresh, and seasonal food, and in supporting local farmers, makers, and the community as a whole, economically and agriculturally. Whole Foods Market believes in food that is vivid and colorful, fresh and full of nutrients. Food that connects you to your body, the seasons, and to nature. Food that helps you do more, sleep better, and wake up happier. Found in over 400 locations throughout the United States, Whole Foods Market only sells food that meets their standards, which means no artificial colors, flavors, preservatives, or sweeteners, ever. Whole Foods Market believes in real food. Visit WholeFoodsMarket.com or download the Whole Foods Market app to learn more.
And we're back on Eating Matters, where today I'm speaking with Paul Wolf, Senior Policy Specialist at the National Sustainable Agriculture Coalition. Before the break, I said I want to talk a little bit more about the commodity program portion, and so let's do that. There was a big focus on changes made to the commodity title and federal crop insurance program in the last iteration. Can you break down in a little bit more detail what those changes were and how they affect farmers? And by the way, whether or not they affect all farmers or just a specific subset of farmers?
Sure. So the one thing to keep in mind, I think, about your last part of that question, before you even delve into this, is that commodity programs are really focused on a handful of staple crops: corn, soybeans, wheat, rice, cotton. These are the programs that they traditionally have focused on. So your specialty crop growers, the fruits and vegetable growers, and even livestock don't have access to any of the commodity programs. When it comes to crop insurance, it is a wider array of crops. There are over 100 crop insurance policies available, but most of those are only available in very specific areas where there's a critical mass for those crops grown. And there's also a type of crop insurance that's kind of like the Cadillac of crop insurance. It's only available for about 15 crops. So one thing to keep in mind is that all of the commodity title programs and the crop insurance programs are really provide the most benefits to a small number of crops. And that's something we're working on. But
Well, why? I mean, my first question is why? Why doesn't it affect, you know, everybody, especially since... you know, you would think that growing fruits and vegetables in this country is a good thing, should be a good thing.
Sure. I mean, I think the part of its history, you know, these are the crops that were grown traditionally for food, but also for feed. And much of the corn and soy today, the vast majority of it is going to feed for animals, mm-hmm. not for human consumption.
Yeah, I think a lot of people don't realize that, actually.
Yeah, it is the vast majority. Corn to cattle, soy to chickens. There's the amount of food grown for human consumption is acreage, you know, committed to human consumption is actually just a small segment. So we had to grow historically these crops on vast numbers of land to grow enough. Some of its history. Some of it's ensuring, you know, adequate prices and a food supply, but it's also, you know, as we've much of it is also exported. So it's kind of a, you know, it's a price, they're a price support program. They're there to help farmers, you know, ensure that they're able to continue farming.
Just a specific set of farmers.
Right. And also, you know, in historically, specialty crop farmers have not necessarily wanted these kind of programs. You know, they remember the Farm Bill was originally passed to help ensure farmers got an adequate price because they were in such dire economic. Today, you know, that's not necessarily the case. But you know, fruits and vegetables cost a lot to grow, and if you have provide support and subsidies for these, in theory, one of the fears is that more people would come in to grow those crops and could actually depress prices. And so it's kind of like how it's kind of backwards. You know, we're providing commodity supports to corn and soybeans and these commodity crops in order to help raise prices. But in effect, we're actually encouraging farmers to pull out shelter belts and pull out fences and grow more of these crops, which then we have to try to find trade agreements and ethanol and other ways to use all the crops that we're growing.
So we're growing too much.
We're growing too much, and you see specialty crop growers don't want subsidies because they worry about people growing too much and depressing prices.
But they have to deal with, I mean, don't they have to deal with through our free trade agreements, like an excess of cheaper produce coming to the market and competing with them anyway?
You know, that is historically, as people may have heard during the, there's a debate going on with the president's attempt to renegotiate NAFTA.
Mm-hmm. We just covered that last episode, by the way. So.
Okay.
Our finger's on the pulse.
Yeah, so everybody knows about it. Everybody's an expert now. And you have you know, historically, different parts of the country fill different niches for fresh vegetables, but a lot of it is coming in from Mexico now because they have cheaper labor, and at certain times of the year that allows, and because of free trade agreements, you know, they are allowed to bring that in. We're essentially sending our corn and soybeans to Mexico, and they're sending us, you know, fresh fruits and vegetables in that deal, at least on the agriculture side.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of companies that grow out in California and the West Coast have operations in both countries. So they're actually, you know, depending on the season, they're growing in both areas.
So, but what about like small family farmers? I mean, I typically think specialty crops, aka vegetables. I think of more small family farmers relying on those types of farms, small and mid-sized farms, to produce right. Those crops. Is that inaccurate?
Oh, well, you know, I don't have the numbers in front of me, but I, you know, a large percentage of those crops come from, at least on the fresh market, are coming from California and Florida, and apples from the and pears from the Pacific Northwest. And at different times of the year, different small areas of the country. But a large percentage are coming from California. So, you know, we obviously support and want to see more diverse and regional food systems. And that's a big part of the Farm Bill as well that we're trying to promote now is the support and infrastructure for those regional and local systems so that those small and mid-scale farmers can access their local markets, because that is one of the biggest challenges, is either not having enough to meet local demand or not being able to get access to markets in an efficient way to compete against the highly efficient and highly mechanized systems in the major growing areas.
So what about, I want to talk a little bit more about this, because we have been seeing kind of a consolidation in the farming industry, especially my understanding is around some of these bigger commodity crops. So is that accurate? And then how can the Farm Bill really kind of encourage a shift away from this kind of consolidation?
Sure. So there's two things. I mean, the Farm Bill does contribute to that consolidation.
How?
The commodity programs that are only available for a small number of crops funnel farmers towards growing those crops. The crops with the most beneficial payments are what your banker wants you to grow, and what the government is telling you to grow. So we focus a lot on the crop insurance program. There's this type of crop insurance called revenue insurance, and the details are not that important, but it essentially it provides kind of a gold standard protection for price and yield problems for farms, and it's only available for about 15 crops. So those 15 crops are what farmers are being kind of steered to. Their bankers are saying, well, what has the best crop insurance? What is the best risk protection from droughts?
Mm-hmm.
It's those crops. And then when you have a situation where you know, you have another crop you want to grow because you have a market for it, you have a buyer, it's good for your farm. We often talk about this as a three crop rotation. So corn and soybeans, very common. Farmers grow corn 1 year, grow soybeans the next. If you add a small grain like barley or oats to that rotation, there are beneficial soil health things. It can help with disease cycle prevention. But if that third crop doesn't have the same kind of crop insurance that corn and soybeans does, that is as generous, it's at a disadvantage. And that's one way we talk about that these programs put these crops at a certain disadvantage. Another way that contributes to the consolidation is that farmers can capitalize these payments into their farm, essentially helping to provide them a guaranteed level of revenue.
Mm-hmm.
And so what happens is the big farms, if you're already big and you get these generous crop insurance subsidies and you get payments from Title I, it helps you avoid having to pay costs on other things around your farm, other expenses, and you have more money to buy more land. There was recently an article in a big national newspaper, mm-hmm, about a farmer in Kansas that has 30,000 acres, which is a huge, huge farm.
Yeah.
And he said it blatantly, he's like, I don't know how a beginning farmer in my area or a mid-scale farmer is going to be able to compete with me to buy land.
Right.
He's able to leverage his size and leverage the government programs to outbid anybody else for that land, so the big get bigger.
Yeah. This is maybe a misconception. So basically, specialty crop farmers are kind of cut out from this. They're very much disincentivized from mostly from entering the market, it sounds like. I do think, however, there is a misconception that farmers, and maybe all farmers, get painted with this brush, but that, like, farmers are getting so much money from the government, almost arguably too much money, and this definitely extends to and, it includes especially crop farmers. What do you say about that? Like, is there some truth to that, or would you say that that's, like, completely false?
Like many things, I think it's somewhere in the middle. We often advocate for means testing and caps on programs.
Mm-hmm.
So that the largest farmers who are most able to internalize risk and don't need as much assistance are not allowed in the programs. But we do think that they're important. Subsidized crop insurance, you know, right now, about 85% of those commodities, those corn, soybean acres are coverage, but only about 26% of vegetables and about 60% of fruit. So those fruit and vegetable farmers do get some support.
Mm-hmm.
They get support. Some of them get crop insurance support. Some of them, and they get support by research dollars.
Okay.
That the federal government provides to help them address disease risks and things like that. But you know, that is not direct subsidies. So, you know, I think it is a misconception.
Which means in this context, sorry to interrupt you, but direct subsidies mean they don't just get the dollars. How do they unlock that funding?
It's through subsidy, through premium subsidy support for crop insurance, and it's through research.
Okay.
So that university research that's done on their behalf.
Yes. Okay. Got it.
So we kind of say, you know, these programs are important. Smaller farmers, mid-scale farmers, you know, the middle of the road, what people traditionally think of a farm, a diversified farm, livestock and crops, do get some support. But what's happening is that the the vast majority of support is going to a small percentage at the largest level. And if you were able to address it, I think that it would make the programs more defensible to the public. I think what you're saying, the public perception is out there, and it is. There's a lot of truth to that. But if we are able to target those supports and not allow them to go to that top 5%, you know, we can really address that perception and really bring it to reality and perception, I think, into line. And there's a lot of good things, you know, a lot of other things that the Farm Bill does that provide funding for farmers that have major benefits for water quality, rural development, things like that. It's conservation programs that, you know, are helping us try to address the Toledo water issue and the dead zone in the Gulf. Those do cost billions of dollars, but they have benefits well beyond the farm.
Here's another, I think, issue that we've been talking about on this show, and it is the maybe fact that there's not a whole lot of coordination amongst some of these smaller and mid-size specialty crop growers, and that, in fact, there's a lot of infighting, and that kind of leads to a lack of an ability to really, like, advocate and lobby for more federal dollars or more just kind of support programs. Is this something that you found to be true, and how do we address that issue, and is there room in the Farm Bill to do so?
Yeah, I think there is. I mean, there is ability to do so. Our organization, we're made up of over 100 organizations all over the country, regionally based, farmer based. We did multiple listening sessions to come up with our agenda for the 2014 Farm Bill, which we released a couple weeks ago. It's about 130 pages of the recommendations that all of our members have come together and to work with their members of Congress and to push for. Mm-hmm. We also recently had introduced Congresswoman Pingree from Maine, Congressman Fortenberry from Nebraska, and Congressman Maloney from the Hudson Valley in New York came together to introduce the Farms Act, the Local Food and Regional Market Supply Act. So, you know, there is consensus, and there is an effort to move forward and to advocate for the local and regional food system and beginning farmers and social disadvantaged farmers in this Farm Bill. So, you know, there may be disagreement, but I think that we're all moving in the same direction.
And what is the role specifically of state and local governments to encourage this? Or is it just sort of all happening at the federal level?
Well, we focus on the federal level, but they're, you know, the state and local are an amazing incubator for the ideas that can go national. We are pushing something called individual development counts, which are a way for to match public funding with farmers' funding to help beginning farmers get started, mm-hmm. and give them financial counseling and get their farm up and going. That's an idea that started at the state level.
Okay.
In a few different states. The states are the incubators of ideas that, if they work, then we can try to expand them and work them on a national scale.
I should have probably asked this a little bit earlier and definitely mentioned it in the introduction, but to what extent does this Farm Bill, affect the lives of everyday Americans?
In many different ways. I think we touched on it a little bit. But it, you know, food safety, and it, you know, if you eat meat, and it has been inspected by USDA, if you are eating fruits and vegetables, you know, it's probably been supported by some sort of research at USDA, or funded USDA funded research to develop new varieties and to fight disease. You know, if you if you've been to the National Forest and you like to hike, you have been on land that USDA manages. If you have been out to a country cidery or a winery, a farm brewery, if you've gone to any of these, there's a good chance that they were helped to develop that idea and to bring that business to the fruition with a with the assistance of USDA. So there's a lot of different ways that this works and impacts the everyday life.
Okay, so I have time for one more question, but basically kind of related to that in terms of how it affects people. How are you working to, you know, energize everybody and to pay attention to these issues? Because, as we know, we live in unprecedented political times right now, and there's just like a lot of noise happening on a lot of issues that some people think are, frankly, more important. So how are you working to just like raise these issues amongst just everyday people and get them to kind of care about right. all of these really, really important aspects of the bill?
Well, I think you mentioned this at the beginning. Farm bill can be kind of a wonky, hard nut to crack kind of thing. But I think our efforts is, you know, being on a podcast like this is one of the ways we're trying to get the word out about things like the Farms Act and the Beginning Farmers and Rancher Opportunity Act. Our theory of change is around leveraging our members all over the country to talk about and rally around bills in Congress that our champions here have introduced. We have one on local food, and we have one for beginning farmers, and talking about those two bills and asking people to go out and talk to their members of Congress and asking them to co-sponsor these two pieces of legislation and doing that through our members. And, you know, the Farm Bill is, I think why you're interested in where we are now is that as we get closer to that end date, interest grows. Mm-hmm. But we really do need to talk more about how it impacts not just rural America and farmers, you know, how it impacts suburban and urban America, and not just through the food stamp program, but through the availability of locally and sustainably produced healthy foods and how we do that.
Certainly. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Okay, so we're going to have to leave it there, but I do want to say I would love to invite you back. We, you know, this was a wonderful primer for all of our listeners. And then moving forward, I would love to kind of, you know, delve into the, you know, your organization's platform specifically for this upcoming bill and what they all mean. So to be continued.
Happy to do it. Thank you for having me.
All right. Thanks so much, Paul.
Thanks.
Okay, for more information about NSAC and its Farm Bill campaigns, you can go to www.sustainableagriculture.net. I want to give a big thanks to our sponsors for their generous support and to our fabulous show intern, Hannah Weiss. Also want to give a big shout out to the best engineer ever, Peter Hirscht. Show music is by Tim Archer, and all episodes of Eating Matters are available on the Heritage Radio Network website or as a podcast on iTunes and Stitcher. If you haven't done so already, please subscribe and leave us some comments. Let us know what you think. I'm Jenna Liut, and thank you for listening. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.